Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage. A blood spatter expert and crime scene reconstructionist took the stand in Alex Murdaugh's trial and offered crucial testimony related to the murders of Maggie and Paul. Timothy Palmbach testified that his analysis pointed to the likelihood that two shooters killed the disgraced lawyer's wife and son. This new piece of evidence completely changes the narrative of the case and has shocked the trial proceedings. The expert's testimony has shed light on who could have been behind the double murder, leaving many to question the possibility of two shooters being involved. Take a listen.
Definitely what would have changed is the pellets coming out of here now would have definitely begun to spread, and you would have seen pellets all across the side of his left side of his face, which you didn't. And then finally, if you look at this angle here again, imagine door here, gun in this thing, then even if, and I think there's no evidence of it, but even if the shot could go through Paul's head and create an exit pathway, then that would project whatever pellets and bone matter that way. Whereas if you move the shooter to the other side and we shoot into Paul downward this way, then all of this material comes back at the shooter, but also it's going this way into that upper corner, which is where we see the pellet defects and the heavy blood and the hair.
Okay, and you'll take a seat. That'd be great.
Thank you.
You can take that down, Doug. Mr. Palmbach, let's talk a little bit about the reconstruction of murder of Maggie Murdaugh. Did you assess the crime scene as it relates to her?
I did.
And what your observations?
Well, generally, there's a couple really key observations. One, all of her wounds were facing the direction of the shooter. So at all times during this, her shooting, she's facing the shooter. Now, she is moving, for sure. There is some degree of movement, from where the initial shooting most likely occurred, which is, we can't give you an accurate estimation for that. We can give you a really good estimation where it ended, and that's where we find her. And I'll talk about which wounds were associated with that in a minute. But you have her facing the attacker the entire time. At no point did she turn or blade or anything other than face him, and moved a little bit in the area, although not much. And then the shooter, based on the overall distribution of the shell casings, also moved again somewhat, moving toward where the ultimate location where we find Maggie.
I'm going to show you two photos. Defense Exhibit 163 and 164, and ask if you relied upon those.
I did.
Defense Exhibit 163 and 64 in the evidence at this time with advocate?
No objection.
Submit it.
So, if you don't mind pulling out 163, Doug. Thank you. And jury's seen this, but just give us an overview of what this is.
Well, Well, so Maggie is underneath the blanket there, and she's in a face down position there.
Just leave it like that, don't
we? Her head is more toward us, and her feet are pointing more toward I think what's been identified as a doghouse.
Right.
You'll see placards in the foreground, 3 and 4, which are two of the blackout 300 casings. You'll see a placard 12, which is over on the grass, more in alignment. You know, we're heading more toward Maggie's head area. And that was a large piece of what appears to be brain-like material. And while you can't see the numbering, there are additional placards to the left, immediately to the left side. Well, they're on Maggie's right side, but as we view the photograph, they're to the left of where she's currently located. So this just gives us some general orientation of approximate locations of the shooter, and certainly where at least the fatal shot to Maggie was taken.
All right. I'm going to show you Defense Exhibit 149. And the other two, we'd move that those be under seal and 149 under seal. Is this, you rely upon this in reaching your conclusions?
I did.
Your Honor, we'd move, Exhibit 194, not 149. 194 in evidence under seal at this time.
No objection.
Move it.
And if you don't mind pulling up, Doug, well, before I do that, let's go to 164, and which is a closer-up area around the side-by-side, as they call it. What's the significance of this photo?
Again, I think this is an area in which Maggie passed by during this incident. It's also an area that's being highlighted now where what appears to be her a damaged loop earring, which is consistent in shape and design and structure to the one that's still in her right ear. This one would have come out of her left ear at the time of that impact, a shot to her left ear, and more or less just been blown over destruction.
And the jury has seen the autopsy photo of the injury to her left ear. Is this, do you believe this earring is a byproduct of that injury?
I do.
Okay. And then just briefly, I'm going to pull up 194 and ask if you can just generally, I think you were hair on her body. What significance is that? And if you'll blow up her legs,
right,
Doug, please.
So, you know, when you find a body, you always have to wonder, is that really the position that the body remained in? Or, you know, through medical, you know, maybe the defendant or the accused or the shooter did something to the body. More likely, in a medical evaluation, they did something to it. We always just want to know, are we looking at it in the right orientation? Did somebody flip it over and whatnot? And so I think it was valuable in this case, to have seen that injury in the back of her head, the massive amount of hair that came off of that. And then if you look close up on the back of her legs, you'll see just dozens and dozens of hairs laying on top of her legs, which would be a good indicator that she didn't get moved. That this is, we can count on this being the final position, unaltered position at Maggie.
Doug, can you go back to 163? You mentioned a marker 12 a moment ago in 163, and again, what do you understand 12 to be?
It's physiological material. I mean, it looks structurally like brain material, but it's tissue.
In your opinion, would the shooter of Maggie have any blood spatter, blood, biological material on him or her?
I think it's possible. I think it's possible because, as we're seeing here, that you have a projection of brain material backwards toward the direction of where the shooter would have been located. We also have a couple of the shots the left thigh shot and the abdomen shot, which have been identified as having stippling around them. By virtue of being stippling, that does make it an intermediate distance, and that's going to move the shooter in anywhere from, I would agree, I think Dr. Einstein said a foot to 3 feet is probably a good approximation.
Okay. Mr. Palmbach, do you have an opinion based upon more probably than not, whether there was one or two shooters who murdered Maggie and Paul on the night of June 7th?
I do have an opinion on that.
And what's your opinion?
My opinion is the totality of the evidence is more suggestive of a two-shooter scenario.
And what, I mean, please explain the basis of your opinion.
Okay. So we'll go back to Paul. In Paul's scenario, we know where the shooter of the shotgun had to be, and that would have been orientated really directly over Paul's head. And we also got a chance to see what was the effect of this dynamic explosion in the contact. And you can see outside and even in throughout the feet area in multiple and many large pieces of skull. We also saw large amounts of tissue that were projected all the way up onto the ceiling and the door. You see hair all the way up into the door. And, of course, you see blood literally everywhere within there. And finally, you see the pellets. Some of the pellets are on that same pathway, and they had enough inertia to either and or dent the door put themselves up and stick into the casing. All of that activity was in direct alignment with the shooter. And so I think minimally, that shooter is getting covered with this material, getting more or less the shock wave of that effect, and more than likely getting hit with at least something that could have done injury, a bone fragment and or a pellet fragment. Therefore, I think that particular shooter, for a brief period of time, is kind of out of this. It's not as if they can instantaneously suffer that, drop the shotgun, run to wherever the AR, the blackout rifle is, pick that up, and then in any kind of a reasonable time period, engage in a meaningful assault, an effective assault, able to shoot straight and make hits. So that, I think, is one of the major indicators of concern. I think the other things to consider is that all of this is very temporal. It's very close. I know when I looked at the photographs versus being there, I'm like, it is much closer together than it looks like in the photo. So it is happening very close. With Paul, as I articulated, I believe he was shot first. I believe he had no idea it was coming. And he took the shot to the chest, and very soon thereafter, the one in the back of his head. Anybody in the near proximity to that, if Maggie had been anywhere in that area walking around down there, she would have heard that, and her response would have been in the direction of the shooter or the activity, or run, or do something different. So I think that the temporal location suggests that these things more probable than not happened fairly quickly, and that the individual who shot first with the shotgun minimally was stunned, probably blood and material in his eyes, and maybe had been injured, and would have taken some degree of time to recover. And lastly, I think there is just more or less in the anybody who deals with firearms, a logical argument here. Why would one shooter bring two long rifles, two long weapons to the event? You can't handle and shoot two of them. So you either got to put one down, use one, and then swap out and grab the other one. Or I suppose you could have one on a sling, but that's quite awkward, and it's slipping around and it's banging around in an environment we know is very, very tight. Finally, if one of the weapons is the Blackout 300, well, that comes with a high magazine capacity. My research of that showed that the Palmetto State Armory upper, which we don't know. We have no idea what gun this is because it hasn't been identified. But if the state, I think, has alluded to that, if that's the case, then a weapon that had that Palmetto State Armory in a 300 blackout, a person could purchase a 10-round capacity clip, a 20-round capacity clip, or a 30-round capacity clip. Where I live in Connecticut, we are really restrictive on what kind of weapons we can have and what kind of clips we could have. we'd have to, even if we could have an AR, which is very restrictive, we'd have to get a 10-round clip. Other than that, it wouldn't make sense for anybody to buy a 10-round clip when you could buy a 20 or 30. But having said that, if it was a 10-round clip, there were only 8 shots fired. You still had 2 more to go, and you could have more than not easily reloaded. So to me, there's structurally difficult for the same shooter to have 2 long arms, and no practical reason for that to happen. Add that to what I believe happened to the shooter who fired first with the shotgun, and I think it tips in favor of the probability of 2 shooters.
Mr. Palmbach, this person who shot Paul, was he or she standing in the feed room at least 1 foot?
Yes.
Was there an opportunity to do a footprint analysis to illuminate more clearly the existence of footprints there?
For sure. I can speak for myself, and I believe others have opined about this, including some of the analysts in the case. There are what appear to be partial footprints in blood in the feed room and on the cement around it. And while I'm not a footwear pattern expert, I can generally recognize what appears to be footwear or partial footwear impressions. I would agree with that. But in order to go beyond it's a general pattern to something more specific, that generally what you do, and I've done this countless and countless times, is you spray enhancement reagents on them. And you spray a reagent, we generally call them blood pattern enhancement reagent, or you can even use a straight protein spray. Imidio Black would be an example of one of those. And by spraying those reagents in the area, it reacts with the presence of blood or proteins, and it brings up the transformation. It gives you a lot more clarity, a lot more detail, and you can tell an awful lot more about a particular footwear pattern. Absolutely should have been done in this case. And I also believe, second to that, you had a lot of dirt in the immediate area that should have had at least partial footwear impressions. And I saw no indication of any attempt to either look for it, photograph it, properly photograph it, or analyze it.
And thank you. One moment, Your Honor. And did Mr. Palmbach, did you see any fingerprint analysis or attempts to obtain fingerprints from the feed room area?
I did not.
Okay. Could you have used reagents like you described to enhance fingerprints, or is that a whole different methodology?
Well, if you thought that the fingerprints could contain blood, which maybe they easily could have, then yes, you could also use those reagents to enhance partially or fully bloody fingerprints. But I think you could also use basic fingerprint processing techniques on the door and any surface in the area. Since we know this is a very confined area and the shooter has to be in that general area, and the possibility of touching something is there. I mean, I think it would have been wise to look for that.
Thank you. That's all I have. Please answer any questions the state may have.
By the state.
That's the latest that we have for you right here. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage in the trial of Alec Murdaugh. My name is Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.